Hi, I'm Liz Taylor, and I'm obsessed with the moments in people's lives that made them turn left or right. What were the events that made them? In this series, I've invited some of my favourite entrepreneurs to share with me their career-defining moments. My guest today is the Carol Nash. Now, every idea starts off small, and for Carol, it started with a phone at the dining room table. You will all know that to me, brand is king, and this woman's brand is huge. If you Google her name, one of the results is Carol Nash a real person? When she sold the business in 2017, Carol Nash Insurance was the largest motorbike insurance brokers in the UK. I've been hugely excited to get Carol on the podcast. She's someone I've known for a long time, and she's bonkers. Good morning, Carol.
Good morning, Liz. Lovely to see you.
And it's lovely to see you. Now, we are just a few days away from a very big birthday party.
Yes.
And there is a marquee over the road at your daughter's house, yeah. And you're going to celebrate 80 years. But today, we're going to wind back a little bit because your story is unbelievable. It's true entrepreneurial. As you said to me, how many men was it, Carol, that you had at your fingertips?
250,000 bikers at my fingertips.
250,000 men at your fingertips. You're looking good for it, Carol. Tell us how it started. Everyone knows the brand and everyone knows that you are famous for successfully building and selling an insurance company for bikers. What do you think was the reason for your success?
I think it was my attitude. I cared for the policyholders and I understood how they felt about their bikes. And I used to answer the phone in the morning from 7:30 when the kids had gone to school to 9:30 at night. And in the old days, on a Friday, they'd ring me, oh, I've got an event on Sunday and I've lost my certificate and I can't tax my bike. I'd prepare them a certificate, get the car out and get the 8 o'clock post in Altrincham.
How did it start and how on earth did you get into motorbikes?
I went back to work part-time sometime when the children were teenagers because they were both clever kids and we thought that you can go back on holidays but you can't go back on your kids' education. I'd had a really good founding in insurance because I'd worked in Manchester when I left school. And then when I got married to Fred, we lived in London for 4 years. So I had some insurance experience in the city. So I went back to work part-time to help with the cash flow. But then, sadly, the insurance company decided to close the Northern office and put everything in Milton Keynes. I'd been in charge of the motorcycle section. So I was involved with a new scheme for historic bikes, the old vintage bikes. And I thought, you know, it's the only one on the market at the moment because I'd been involved in the setting up of it. I came home from the office and I knew I was being made redundant. And I came home and I said to Fred, while we were doing the washing up, I said, you know, I could do this scheme from home. So he said, well, why don't you? Oh, I said, I don't know. So I went marching back into the office, told the manager, could I do it from home? Now, this particular scheme had no claims on it or anything because the old boys loved their old bikes. They treasured them. So I asked, could I do it from home? So they said, yes, but on an independent basis. So when I was made redundant, it's a challenge and an opportunity that doesn't come around again. I'm going to see if I can do this scheme from home. So I had 2,300 redundancy money. I bought a professional indemnity, which I had to have.
Just explain to the listeners what a professional indemnity policy
is. Well, it's an insurance in case you do make mistakes.
Okay.
Because also I was told I had to issue the policies myself. Well, it was a very big, what's the word?
It was a responsibility.
A responsibility, issuing the policies myself as well, because the insurance company didn't want to have anything to do with it. And they relied on my ability and my knowledge of insurance, the road traffic acts and all things like that, to be able to issue the policies.
So in effect, at that time, you were working for yourself?
Yeah, I was. I was self-employed. On the 1st of November 1985, I had £30 left from all my redundancy money. I put a new telephone line on the dining room windowsill and a pad and some pencils, and that's how Carol Nash was born.
And what year did you sell out? We're going to go on the journey in a minute. But
2006.
And for how much money?
Well, it was quite amazing, really, because I interviewed so many different solicitors who would carry the sale. And they told me that, they briefed me that when it goes to the market, you'll have four at the end who are really interested. And I had 10. So, of course, that put the price up even more. So in the end, a French company bought it, Groupama, and they offered me 70 million for it.
Groupama, if I'm correct in thinking, were Groupama bought out by Budget Insurance, BGL? They were.
They were bought out by another, but they've still been bought out again. So there's quite a string of buyouts.
Because I worked for 17 years for Budget Insurance. I was responsible for literally implementing their motivational events for the directors. And we went to New York, we went to Istanbul, we went all over the world with them. They were an amazing client. And BGL rebranded and became, Budget Insurance rebranded and became BGL. And Groupama were one of their brands. I think they had 10 brands.
I think
brands.
They were French.
They were French.
They were French.
And they were one of their brands. And I'm going to investigate that, I think. So you sold out for 70 million.
70 plus million.
So from the kitchen table, from a £2,300 payout to a £30 left in the bank to buy a phone line, you sold out for 70 million.
Yeah.
I think that's the end of this interview, Carol. I think it's absolutely the most amazing. And I am in awe. Now, do you regret selling it?
I miss the camaraderie because I was a worker with them. I mean, if they were really busy, I'd still make them coffee. Even there was 300 working for me.
You can't possibly have made 300 coffees. Okay. I mean, I know that you're talented and that you...
And they'd have a Kit Kat. Buy them a Kit Kat. But also, for every birthday, all the girls got a bouquet of a bunch of flowers from me and the boys got 6 cans of lager. And at Easter, everybody got an Easter egg off me. So although it grew bigger and bigger, we still had that family feel about it.
Carol found massive success in her industry, but there's one thing that sets her apart, and that's she never stopped caring. She cared about her customers because she knew that their bikes were their most important treasures. And she cared about her staff and always looked after them with those family values. In the events business, caring has been huge to me. Every Friday, we have a group lunch. Whatever the week, wherever we are, I buy lunch, Wagamama or Yo Sushi or Indian or whatever fancy takes them, and sit down with my team and we enjoy and reflect on the week behind and the week ahead. When I'm on site, I do it with my suppliers. They're there 24/7, building marquees, installing light rigs, creating flower displays, and I rock up with fish chips and mushy peas, and we sit down on the floor and we bond. That's why I have worked with the same suppliers for over 30 years. The loyalty and respect is mutual. The fish and chips, optional. It's the little things that make the big things. It's the little moments when they know that I appreciate them. Without them, I would not have the TLC brand. My saying is, and always has been, be nice to people on the way up because you will see them again on the way down. Now, Carol has found all of this success. I want to know why she sold.
There was a lot of issues within the company.
Am I right in saying that you were unaware that you were being cheated?
I was unaware that there was things going on behind my back, and there was a certain characters within the company who really would like to see me out, and they undervalued the company only on their own back. So I decided for my 65th birthday, I'd been going 20 years, it was time to sell. But also the bureaucracy of the paperwork, the FSA, I mean, it just drove me up the wall. I was a cottage industry that grew and grew and grew, but it grew with all the love and affection from me, and it just fell apart. It was just ridiculous, and I decided it was time to sell.
So you sell the business, you ride off on your bike with stabilisers into the sunset, well, hail, actually,
yeah.
And then wham, when you end up having major heart surgery, how long after that?
Must be about 12 years after. I did go through a very stressful period after I sold the company because I had so much publicity and people say you want to, you'll get begging letters, but I didn't. I think it was because my personality and my interviews were so sincere. I didn't boast. Because on my 61st birthday, the press came to interview me, bearing in mind all this money I'd just received. And they said, are you going to Paris for the weekend for your birthday? I said, no, I'm having a takeaway. I think that summed me up, really.
What was it, Chinese or Indian?
Chinese.
I just like to know these things, you know. But you see, 70 million 20 years ago has got to be, I don't know what it is the equivalent of now. I mean, that is a stonking amount of money. Were you overwhelmed by it?
Yes.
Were you?
I was. And also, I was in the rich list the following year for the Sunday Times. And there was a photograph of me with, like, hair clips in my hair, all done like motorbikes.
Maybe that's how you came to TLC, because I trawl through the rich list to get my clients, Carol. So maybe that's how you came to me. No,
I think I'd been always recommended to you.
I'm teasing you because the rich list is, I think, I don't like the, I mean, it's brilliant for people in business like me.
I've never been happy with all the money, and it took me 10 years, I think, to tell people. I mean, it was ready, it was in the papers how much I'd got for it.
Do you think it's brought you happiness?
It's provided with a lot of things that the... I mean, my son and daughter were shareholders. They got a substantial amount. There's not many mothers that make their kids millionaires.
No, I think no, but mine are still trying.
I flew down to City Airport quite a few times to meet with accountants and solicitors when we're sealing the deal. But one of the things that we couldn't do, because we're all three of us were directors, we couldn't go on the same plane. And that really...
Did that bring it home to you?
Yes. Yeah, we couldn't go on the same plane.
Because you couldn't all crash together.
If we all couldn't crash together. So that I think that I thought, my God, I am important. Because I think this is my whole thing. I've always had a low esteem of myself. And it's something that's always there. And up to a point, I think it still is now. I like to stand in the background.
Do you think that, and this is a very leading question here, because I think that when the more successful partner in a marriage is a woman, I think that leads to low self-esteem, because I think it's very, very difficult to live with a man who can accept his wife's success. Now, I don't say that Fred wasn't successful. I don't think it has any reflection on the man. It doesn't matter how successful the husband is. I think that when the wife is so successful, you automatically have this overwhelming sense of guilt to a certain extent. And I believe that. And I think that that is... Unfortunately, I think that's one of the things we carry being an entrepreneur.
Yeah, I think so, because I'd only been left school. I was 19 and started going out with Fred. And he was a manager then. He was a claims manager. So, and I was his little girl.
Just let's go back, because we were talking about the stress of the buyout, of the sellout or the buyout, and the heart surgery that followed. And do you think that was as a result of that stress?
I had a lot of stress. I think as I got more successful, you see, when I was at home, I used to make all the, do my husband's eye, you know, iron his dress shirts for his law society dues and that. And suddenly I was beginning to bloom in my own right.
How?
Well, people knew me, press interviews, award winning.
Do you think he resented that?
He was an old fashioned husband who thought the wife's place, I think, was at home. And I loved, at the time, I used to make jam, homemade cakes, and that's the sort of thing that we were brought up to be. And he was so devoted to Malcolm and Jane all the time, you know, all the time.
But I think you've balanced that really well, because there is a huge part of you. I'm sat in here, it's December, and this house looks like Santa's grotto, you know, magnificently decorated, very welcoming, even though I've not been offered a coffee, but we'll swerve that. But very welcoming, very warm. It's always, you know, and you never have to take your shoes off. And that is very much part of you. We haven't got the glitz and the glamour that comes with a £70 million buyout. And so I think you balanced that very well with him. I just wonder whether there was resentment, because the success was huge.
Well, it was. And he went along with it. But there were times where he would walk away from it.
And how did he feel, you know, wham, bam, you've all of a sudden, you're having major heart surgery. And so your reality sets in. And tell me how that changed, did that change your life?
Well, I went for a stress test. I absorb everybody else's stress, that's me. And I carry such a lot of baggage, which I didn't need to. And I went for a stress test, and they said, oh, your stress test, I think you have an angiogram first, and they put dye in your heart. And they couldn't do it because of the state of my heart. So they got me into the Alex within 2 weeks, and I had a double bypass and a new valve. And I was in intensive care for 4 days. And I came out and I had infections where the vein came in my leg. But I'm a fighter, and I got over it.
Do you think it made you think differently or not?
Not at that time, no. I put up with it. I thought, oh, well, it's a fact of life. But then, because Fred's health was deteriorating, and I had a most fantastic GP, and she used to come and visit me every fortnight, and I'd gone up to 15 stone. And she said, I think you need some exercise. Bearing in mind that years and years ago, I was a games sort of person. So she said, I'll give you the name of a personal trainer. So she wrote it down, put it on the coffee table. A month later, I'd done nothing about it. She said, I think you ought to ring Mike. So I rang him. But he never came back to me. I thought, thank God for that. But I didn't know. He was on holiday for 3 weeks. So eventually he caught up with me. And I went to his gym. Oh, my God, I thought, I don't like this. But by his encouragement, he got me thinking the right way. And then he decided that I should walk. Well, I'd never walked for years. I mean, you just get in the car and go to Sainsbury's anywhere. So on a Saturday morning, he said, I'm going to walk you around the block. So he'd come to the gate for 9:30. I think, oh, my God, I wish he'd go away. He didn't, and he persevered with me. And he's been the best thing since sliced bread.
How long have you been training with him?
2.5 years.
And when did Fred pass away?
2 years ago.
So just 6 months before.
Yes. And of course, then the lockdown came, but we did it online. And I still go now 4 times a week. And it's just part of my life.
So for the listeners' benefit here, I'm looking at a seriously glamorous 40 times two, you said. You said, yeah. I'm not 80. You said, I'm 40 times two. Have you had any plastic surgery?
No. Nothing.
So that skin's all your own?
All my own.
No stitches at the back or anything?
No.
Wish I could say the same, Carol. Carol's heart surgery and the resulting recovery is another moment that changed her life. As a child, Carol loved sports at school, but somehow, in and amongst setting up her business, that fell by the wayside. Mental health and your own well-being has never been more prominent than it has been during COVID. The last 2 years have put pressure on everybody. Every morning for me starts on the treadmill. I run to some godforsaken place that overlooks the sea. I clear my head and I set myself up for the day. It's hugely important to take that time out. I don't rush to the office for 8 o'clock anymore. I've changed our opening hours from 10 till 5 so that my girls and my team can go to the gym in the morning. I look after myself a little bit more. I step away from it, but I am still as focused and as driven as I ever have been. I'm just aware that I am not immortal. Because of her fitness regime now, Carol is making every day count. While she's achieved so much, I wanted to hear about the one award that really stood out for her.
During the journey, I think the one that stands out most was when in 2002, I was awarded the Personal Lines Broker of the Year. They'd never had a woman in insurance running a company, and to get it in the way I did was unbelievable. That always stands in my mind.
I mean, it was a very male-orientated business.
And it was a male-orientated hobby as well.
So let me ask you, how old were you when you learnt to ride a motorbike?
I can't ride a motorbike. I'd need stabilisers.
I thought you've got a motorbike in the garage, haven't you?
Yes, I had a collection. Quite a few press photographs over the years. I had one called The Old Lady, a 1914 all original combination. But sadly, since my husband passed away 2 years ago, we sold the hall in Wales. I haven't got the accommodation to store them. So actually, they went to auction last year.
Now, I know since Fred passed away, you've been sort of on a bit of a bucket list mission. Mm. So you've recently lost God knows how many stone, but you look like a completely different person. And you have renewed your confidence and decided to live. You've got this orange Porsche Carrera outside with CN, which is really subtle, like no one would notice it. Would you not consider, because I would do it with you, I actually enrolled for a motorbike course last August in Salemore. It's a day thing that you can go on, but for lots of reasons I won't go into, I didn't do it. Would you not like to ride a motorbike? Is that not...
No.
Why?
Well...
Is it not safe, Carol?
No.
Do you need good insurance?
No. No, it's the fact that it's the balancing, but I did substitute... a two-wheel bike for a three-wheel Morgan. And I used to drive a Morgan three-wheeler, 1948 Ford engine side valve, which is taxed as a tricycle, so it can go in either car or motorcycle events. And it has been with me to East Germany, Sweden, France, in events. And the East German one, I thought I was going to get arrested by the secret police.
What had you done? Why did you think you were going to be arrested by the secret police?
Well, first of all, we're in a Morgan three-wheeler on the East German Autobahn. We crossed over from Helmstedt. We've got to remember that the Berlin Wall was still up. And we drove down the Autobahn, chased by the secret police. They caught up with us. We pulled in on the side of the road. What they said, all they wanted to do was look at the Morgan. They'd never seen one like it before. And there's me thinking I was going to go to the salt mines and never see Timperley again.
Brilliant story. Brilliant. Now, I know that you're very philanthropic, extremely generous. You support all sorts of different causes. Tell me about the Carol Nash Hall in the Royal Northern College of Music and the Carol Nash Room in Chetham's, which is both very, very well-established music schools. Where does all that come from?
Well, I think music has always been a common denominator in my life. Because, you know, I was born in Moss Side, and the family house there was a very musical household. My great-granddad was a retired bandmaster and an oboe player. My grandmother was a constant pianist, but she used to play for the silent films. My father was a good pianist. So music was around me. But God knows what happened when it came to me. I preferred hockey and tennis. But it came out in my daughter, and she is a very talented musician. So music was always there, and I grasped an opportunity with the business that never comes round a second time. So after I'd sold the company, I mean, I'm not a glitzy person, and I wanted to make other people's lives, improve their lives and their hobbies and their outlook. So the first thing I did actually was, the Halley was 100 years old, and I went with Kathy Stott, the concert pianist. We went to Frankfurt, we went to Hamburg, to the Steinway, and between it we chose a piano, a concert piano for the Halley, and it's still used now, a concert grand.
Do you play the piano?
I do, in my own little way, but sadly my daughter, who is a music teacher, thinks I play with my elbows.
I've played since I was 4. I started when my mother asked me what I wanted for my birthday. I said piano lessons, and I studied music right till I was 18. Mm. I used to play, and I actually applied for the Yehuda Menuhin School, but I didn't get in. But I love music. Music yeah. is the thing that motivates me. Yeah. Music, I think, if you're creative, or a bit bonkers, or I just think music is the most wonderful, wonderful tool. And I'm sat here looking at this magnificent grand piano in your lounge.
Yes.
Currently not being played. Tell me, would you say that your upbringing was privileged?
My father was a chemist, so his occupation was a little bit more upmarket.
So you were looked after,
yes,
and you were educated.
And there was good food on the table. I went to Wally Range High School.
Did you go to university?
No, I didn't want to go to university.
So you went straight to work?
I went straight to work. But I stayed at school till I was nearly 18 and a half because I loved games, sports. But I always had a love of music, even Meatloaf now and bebopping and that.
So that was really your incentive to support the music schools,
yeah,
in the Northwest.
I had an interest, more than an interest, in music. And then I was approached by the Royal Northern. They were desperate to improve the rooms, especially the sound recordings, for when the students went for interviews, to be able to give them a much better standard of their work. So this is when I set to, and we had the Carol Nash room, and we used all the, and we had the Carol Nash sound for all there. And that's how that all started.
Obviously, Carol is in a position where she can financially support the causes that she cares about, which is fantastic. But giving back or showing support doesn't always mean spending money. My most valuable assets are my contacts. And I have used them and continue to use them to support various charities. I'm not in a position to make huge donations, but I am in a position to pull on my contacts to raise money for the causes that tug at my heartstrings. A few years ago, I was involved in Children in Need when I worked with Gary Barlow to raise hundreds of thousands of pounds for this amazing cause. And I even got a Bentley thrown in. I then, in 2018, raised money for child bereavement, calling on Gary Neville and Gary Barlow again to help me in raising over £500,000. This year, I have a new project up my sleeve, Shall We Dance? And I've got Anton de Beck and the wonderful Arlene Phillips to support me in a Strictly Styled event where we're going to raise £250,000 for 5 charities. Yes, there'll be another Bentley, Howard Donald from Take That. So I'm using all my resources to put something back into a business that I've loved and that has supported me for over 30 years. I think it's really important for us all to look at ourselves and think, What can I give back? What can I do? It doesn't have to be money. It can be time. It can be patience. It can just be a listening ear. Anything that you can do to give back into the community is worth its weight in gold. Now, we don't always get everything right the first time around. I wanted to know if, given the chance, Carol would do anything differently, or if she'd get on the same bike and drive it down the same road again.
Life's always been a challenge. I mean, talking about taking me anywhere, I've had lunch with, the Duke of Edinburgh on three occasions, Windsor Castle, Frogmore House, and I have got a claim to fame, which I don't think I've told you about. Sitting next to the Duke, I'm always fiddling with my serviettes, and I dropped it on the floor three times. And there's not many women that can say they've had their serviette picked up by the Duke of Edinburgh three times.
What a gent.
I know.
The Queen, you must
I've had the Queen. My Queen did my OBE.
What did she say to you? Did she know who you were?
Yes, she knew how I was, and I'd got it for charitable causes. Yes. Yes, and she knew also, I'd met her previously, that I'd bought the piano, for the Halle Orchestra, and she said, I hope it comes up to scratch.
Of course, remember, do you remember your anniversary party, what we did?
Yeah, we had, yes.
So I've got to share that with the listeners. So yeah. When you came to me, you wanted to do an anniversary party, and we decided...
garden party.
Yes, because you are like the Queen.
Yes.
So the invitation had the crest, and we did the Royal Garden Party, and we got, I don't know if she's still around, but Jeanette Graham, who was the Queen tribute, with two of the soldiers.
And the corgis. Oh, actually, I don't do things by halves.
And we wrote the speech. We personalised the speech to you and Fred. And it was one, it must have been 20 years ago. How many?
Yeah, it must be 20, yeah. It's still talked about today.
She was phenomenal. Yeah. She was phenomenal. And yeah, I remember because you were just so sort of terribly regal and very important.
But it's funny, though, that... they still call me the old queen at times, my son. And that is because when I first ever made my first speech many years ago, I was presenting to the bikers with some awards at the bike show, I think Stafford. And I came to start my speech and I heard a whisper saying, oh my God, it sounds like 3 o'clock on Christmas Day. And that's why they call me the old queen.
Well, if ever they need a stand-in, Carol, we can submit you. We can send your CV in for services. So you've met all the royal family, the Queen, the Duke of Edinburgh, yes. The Duke of York.
Yeah, the Edward, Prince Anne, all at various events.
So you must be really secretly very proud of yourself.
I am, in a way. I mean, you know.
Well, you're entitled to be. And when you look back over 80 years and, you know, and listen, one thing I can assure you is I'll be doing your 100th birthday. Well, in fact, you'll be here. I might not be here, but I'll be doing, TLC will be doing your 100th birthday. But you are entitled to be proud because you built up an empire on a kitchen table. You educated two children privately. You kept a wonderful family home. You sold out for an enormous amount of money. You've met all the royal family. You are an established British brand. You're 80 years old and you're still laughing. What more can you want out of life? Carol, thank you so, so much for this. It's been wonderful and I hope that you've enjoyed it too.
Thank you so much, Liz. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
The one thing that I've taken away from my conversation with Carol is humility. Her acknowledgement of her staff, suppliers, charities, causes, the human touch that has been the thread throughout her life. So go listen to this episode's air extension, which is all about humility. Thank you so much for listening. If you've enjoyed this episode, please leave a 5-star review. If you want more stories about my own business adventures, buy my book, Tailor Made, now available everywhere. I'll be back on the 27th of January with another amazing entrepreneurial guest. So I'll see you then.